May 28, 2012. 6 days ago, four women operating as aid workers in Afghanistan were kidnapped and held for ransom. They were citizens of Britain, Kenya, and Afghanistan, respectively. The crisis fell to ISAF, the International Security Assistance Force, to handle. It eventually fell to the British and U.S. governments. Both governments have a policy that they don't negotiate with terrorists, but they aren't planning on negotiating. They're planning on a hostage rescue.
A hostage rescue, a SEAL holds dear to his heart. They go in there mainly to save a life. They risk their lives to go save a life. Now, if it's an innocent woman, if it's children, if it's aid workers, it doesn't matter. They're going in there to save lives.
But operating on the tails of several failed rescues, this one will count even more.
You get involved in anything involving armed conflict, lethal force, can always go wrong. Can always go wrong.
Welcome to Covert, a show about the shadowy world of international espionage and top secret military operations.
As far as the execution of the operation goes, you would have real-time intelligence on the ground from photography, aerial photography. You would know their routine. You would know the weapons.
I'm Jamie Rennell, and I'm going to take you inside history's greatest special forces missions to learn about the brave soldiers and operatives who risked their lives to terminate the world's most wanted, eliminate terrorist threats, and protect countless innocent lives.
It actually says, you know, the other side of this, sort of the narrative to this whole story, as well as getting the hostages back, is don't mess with the British. Don't kidnap our people, because this is what's going to happen to you.
British Special Air Service and the American SEAL Team 6 were ready to work together on an in-and-out rescue mission, but their intelligence was limited, and with failure in their wake, no one was certain they could pull it off.
The element of surprise is gone since the first bullet's been put, the first trigger's been pulled, and then it's speed, aggression, and surprise.
This is Operation Jubilee, Part 2. The SAS and SEAL operatives were on their way to an area outside of Badakhshan. They'd gotten the go-ahead to plan a mission. Now, it was waiting to be greenlit. The operatives began strategizing how to take out the kidnappers. Former SAS pilot Nigel Ellie spoke about the importance of these mental rehearsals.
You have to do rehearsals, be it just a quick 5 minutes, but every man has to know the job. So you do a walkthrough rehearsal, you have a sand model, whatever's available at the time, depending on where you're giving your brief or where you've planned your mission. It could be back in the ops room with full facilities, or it could be out in the field somewhere in the desert. And you have to make do with bits of rock, twigs, and then you walk through it as you physically walk through like a condensed situation.
The key to a successful mission wasn't about knowing their environment. Because of the terrain and location, the group had very little intel about where they were going into, and they likely wouldn't get much more until they were on the ground. The most important thing was knowing how they would operate, and more critically, how everyone else would be operating.
It's not to make you familiar with the environment, because you know the environment. It's to make you familiar with the method of infiltration.
One of the key problems was how to get the hostages without being detected. They would head to the two cave networks where the hostages were likely being held, but the networks were such a remote region that the troops would need to be inserted by helicopter. And likely, if the kidnappers heard them, the hostages would be killed. So, they had to land 2 miles from the caves in order to maintain the element of surprise. From there, they would then march on foot. Finding a place to land was also tricky. The terrain of the area was hilly. Sean Raymond is a journalist who researched this rescue operation.
Very mountainous, very challenging terrain, characterized by high ranges, forests. Very, very difficult to penetrate. Completely different to the south. Difficult to move around, limited roads, poor roads. So all of those, you know, you can imagine.
Understanding what they're getting into included rehearsing the physical elements of the mission, but it also includes studying what the captives look like. Former Navy SEAL Don Mann.
Our operations centers, tactical operations centers, have a board of hostages in the country, known terrorists, terrorists on the hit list, and the SEALs will come in, the operating units will come in, and they look at this every day. They memorize what these hostages look like. They know what the terrorists look like.
They don't want to accidentally kill the captives. The mistakes made in the failed rescue of Linda Norgrove still hung heavy. But former intelligence agent Frank Ledwidge said that mistakes are sometimes par for the course.
In fairness to the soldiers involved in the Linda Norgrove incident, it's often called botched, when you get involved in anything involving armed conflict, lethal force, it can always go wrong. It can always go wrong.
Planning a mission like this one was about planning for the unknown as much as the known.
Someone once said, in war, everything is simple. But the simple things are incredibly difficult. And that's the type of thing which can happen in a special forces operation. And the helicopter could have gone down. Suddenly there might be, instead of just five or six kidnappers, there might be 20 or 30. They may have moved the hostage. They may be in the process of moving the hostage. So all these factors need to be considered.
7 days after the initial capture, they hear just that. Some of the hostages had been moved. Hey folks, real quick, I want to talk to you about one of today's sponsors, Mint Mobile. If you're still using one of the big wireless providers in 2019, have you asked yourself what you're paying for? Between all the expensive retail stores and inflated prices and hidden fees, you're really being taken advantage of because they know you'll pay. Enter Mint Mobile. See, Mint Mobile provides the same premium network coverage you're used to, but at a fraction of the cost because everything is online. Mint Mobile saves on retail locations and overhead, and then they pass those savings directly to you. So one of the things that I was worried about was switching to a smaller carrier because I was afraid of the network and losing coverage and all that kind of stuff. And you know what? Frankly, that's a big myth. Mint Mobile gives you the exact same quality coverage as one of the big companies because they use their networks. Mint Mobile makes it easy to cut your wireless bill down to $15 a month. Every plan comes with unlimited nationwide talk and text. With Mint Mobile, you can stop paying for unlimited data that you'll never use. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and keep your same phone number along with all your existing contacts. And that's something that I didn't know that I could do. I thought I had to have an unlocked phone, and I didn't. Guess what? Mint Mobile will help you unlock your phone so you don't have to buy a whole new device. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to ditch your old wireless bill and start saving with Mint Mobile. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/covert. And that's important, covert. That's mintmobile.com/covert. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/covert. One of the drones monitoring the positions gleaned the intel that Helen and Morgarway had been separated from their Afghan guides. There were now two groups of hostages held in separate caves in different locations, and the locations were over a mile apart. The operatives needed to adjust their plan. They would have to stage both rescue operations at the same time to maintain that key surprise element. And the intel was only giving them more bad news. British intelligence had intercepted a phone call from one of the hostage locations. It was a conversation between the kidnappers and the Taliban. Journalist Sean Raymond said this was the first step in what could lead to even more dire straits.
The gang would essentially be made up of criminals, but a wider network than that. For a criminal organization to operate in Afghanistan, it's probably going to rub shoulders at some stage with the Taliban, with insurgents. And if you're rubbing shoulders with the Taliban, you're probably rubbing soldiers with Al-Qaeda. You want weapons, they've got weapons.
If the group gets involved with the Taliban, they'll have more resources, more people, more weapons, more intelligence. And the intercepts suggested they were planning to do a deal.
They may have realised at that stage that perhaps they were a little bit out of their depth and that they could sell the hostage on to the Taliban. The Taliban might be interested in that because they could sell the hostage on to Al-Qaeda. And that's always the worry. If they're in the hands of Al-Qaeda, there is little precedent for actually getting anyone back.
Now, the women's lives could be in very real danger. And not only that, but the whole operation could be in peril if the Taliban was involved. They'd had conflict with the SAS before.
Well, have the Taliban got people watching the SAS compound? Are they seeing helicopters going? You know, does there seem to be a lot of activity? You know, that could be getting back and forward. So once you press the button on this and say, yes, we're going to do this operation, you want to go as quickly as possible. My understanding is that what the special forces had done, by the time that the Prime Minister and the Kenyan Prime Minister says, yes, we're going to go for this operation, the special forces have already pretty much close to establishing their forward operating base in a provincial reconstruction team headquarters, 30 miles from the target anyway, which is where they carry out their final briefings, carry out their final rehearsals, that they know what the target is going to be. Timing is absolutely crucial.
The ISAF analysts expected that the kidnappers would complete the deal with the Taliban within 24 hours. They had to act now.
In this case, an intercept came in to the effect that a Taliban unit had asked for a show of intent, kill one of the hostages, and hand the other one over. So that's a trigger point. That's a decision point. That's a point at which senior command will have been notified with a request for a decision, go or no-go, at this point.
General John Allen, American commander of the ISAF, could wait no longer. He relayed the information to London and advised that the mission be put into effect immediately.
It was at that point that things started to move very, very quickly. And I think within a matter of hours, the Prime Minister in this country, probably the Prime Minister in Kenya as well, was told that they needed to launch a military operation very quickly to recover the hostages. Otherwise, there was a very strong risk that one of them would have been killed.
The mission was greenlit. It's a go. Now, as former SAS fighter Nigel Ellie explained, the nuts and bolts of the operation were finalized.
As far as the execution of the operation goes, you would have real-time intelligence on the ground from photography, aerial photography. You would know their routine. You would know the weapons.
Even with a group of 70, the operatives were on high alert as they ran through the final checks. They only partially knew what they were up against, and any errors could be catastrophic.
Afghanistan is very, very difficult. I mean, we're actually going in the backyard of the enemy. We're trying to fight the enemy on their turf. And we're doing a good job of it. We're doing a good job of it. But when it comes to going into the mountains, when it comes to taking our helos through those mountain passes, it really just takes one lucky Taliban shooter with a shoulder-fired weapon and he can knock out a helicopter out of the sky.
The two Spec Ops commanders broke the plan down into stages. First, the helicopters would touch down about 2 miles from the caves. This would be far enough away to mask the engine noise. Former SEAL Don Mann explained how coordinated the team had to be to operate in silence.
They will board the helicopter, so the first shooter's out. They come up, they do a 360 security. Every shooter comes around, and they have back-to-back, and they're looking, so they have 360 security. All the weapons ready to fire. The helicopter lifts off, and now they're looking and listening and detecting any sounds using all their senses to see or hear if there's anybody in the immediate area. At that point, they know where how far it is to the cave. The team will group up together, or they'll split apart initially, and they go into their respective caves. There'll be a point man established. The point man is the person who's navigating to that cave. Navigating using GPS, map, or compass, and they're heading to the cave on the point man's direction. It's all hand and arm signals, radio traffic, and it's very quiet, very stealthy. They take the most direct route or the path of least resistance. Once they get up to the cave, they already know if they have the element of surprise on their side.
After landing, the troops would split into two assault forces. The SAS would target the cave where they believe British Helen Johnson and Kenyan Morgarwe Oriere were being held. Meanwhile, SEAL Team 6 would advance on a separate cave complex and rescue the Afghan workers. The goal was for both units to simultaneously storm the caves, neutralize the kidnappers, and secure the hostages. Lastly, the hostages and troops would evacuate and fly by helicopter back to the base.
They would know the timings, the weather, the wind state, everything. As much intelligence as possible. They would have had a thorough understanding of exactly what they wanted, minute by minute, step by step, from the beginning of the operation to the actual rescue and extraction.
So the other day I had somebody actually ask me if I used forhims.com because I actually have hair. Well, yeah, of course I use forhims.com because I don't want to lose the hair that I have. You know, I mean, summertime is here. I'm always wearing a baseball cap. I'm out trying to keep the sun off my face. And it's kind of to hide a little bit of a thinning bald spot on the back of my head. Did you know that 66% of men lose their hair by age 35? So do something while you still have hair and while you still can. Forhims.com. It's a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, sexual wellness for men. Listen, Hims connects you with real doctors and medical-grade solutions. These are well-known generic equivalents to name-brand prescriptions to help you keep your hair. And here's my favorite part. I don't actually have to go to the doctor. There's no waiting room. There's no awkward in-person doctor visits. You can save hours by going to forhims.com. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to order now. My listeners get a trial month of Hims for just $5 a day, right now while supplies last. Go to the website for the full details and safety information. Listen, this would cost you hundreds if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy. Go to forhims.com/covert. That's forhims.com/covert. forhims.com/covert. Friday, June 1st, 2012, 1 p.m. Just 4 hours before takeoff. There would be nearly 70 troops. Helicopter space was limited. This meant they could only take the bare essentials.
When SEALs go in on a mission, they try to stay light. They try not to carry a lot of gear because it slows you down. They don't want to be slowed down. They're in and out quickly is how it should happen. So basically, you're going in. You might have a helmet on. You have a helmet on, probably with a camera. Okay, you've got that. You've got your goggles because of wind blast and the helo. You've got a mic so you can talk on the radio. You've got body armor, hopefully, front and back. You got a sidearm, which is your secondary weapon. It's a pistol. It's usually a 9mm pistol. And you got your assault weapon. It could be an AK. It could be an M4. It might be a submachine gun.
As the light began to fade, the MH-60L Black Hawk helicopters wait on the flight line.
So, okay, so you're approaching the chopper. Now, it's any soldier will tell you this that's been on ops. The smell of avgas that's burnt by the helicopter is just it's just instills a bit of sort of seriousness into the whole situation. Okay, this ain't no computer game. This is for real. So you board the helicopter, constantly checking your weapon, making sure that the magazine is still there. You're checking your pouches on your webbing and everything. And you know, some people have a nervous twitch and. You know, other people don't. It's just the way they deal with it. Of course, they get in, then the cold air of the helicopter coming in as the helicopter rises, the noise of the rotor blades going, and then all of a sudden you're up and you're off. And everybody's pretty deep in thought for a couple of seconds, and then sort of it comes out again, the noise that, and people are sort of, there's the radio, you can probably just hear the radio, see something up front with the pilot talking or whatever.
The flight to the landing zone was only 30 minutes, just enough time to do some last gear checks. The first troops on the ground secured the helicopter landing site at the top of a rocky valley. They then coordinated the arrival of the remaining Blackhawks to come back for them. The helicopters flew off into the night, leaving the soldiers in the dark, 2 miles from the caves.
There's absolute silence. And then the sweat is then mixed with this cold air, and then you realise that, you know, this is it, this is it. You know, the helicopter's gone, we're going in, all right? And then if it's at night, you have these PNGs, your night goggles on, and then you go into your routine, because you've rehearsed it. You know what to expect, and then once everything's set and you believe there's no enemy about, you move off, all silent, and you move off to a point that you already know where it is, and that's the start line.
The assault force made their way forward for about a mile, then split up to head off to the two different objectives. The two-mile march is not difficult for the soldiers, but the hard part is keeping it quiet.
To do a two-mile trek in the woods at night silently takes a long time. They can make faster time at the initial part of the trek, because stepping on branches and making noise as you're walking is not going to be heard at the target. But once you get up 500 meters or so in front of the target, things slow down. You might stop, everybody scans, looks around, walks, takes a couple of steps, paying a lot more attention to how they're stepping and where they're stepping.
From the operating room in Kabul, General Allen and the British Deputy Lieutenant General Adrian Bradshaw were watching over the events. From afar, the commanders maintained full situational awareness. All of the soldiers had head cameras. They could see clearly as the SAS arrived at the first location and slowly approached the cave. At the other cave, the SEALs were doing the same. Don Mann explained that the team had to be well-versed in their own code of hand signals to maintain that silence.
Once you get really close up, and you're getting ready what we call the stack to attack a building, sometimes there's squeezes. It means I'm ready. You give the squeeze to the guy in front of you. The guy behind me is ready, I'm ready, and then he'll pass it up, and you might just go with squeezes. If it's really, really dark, and it's in the jungle or the dense forest, you might travel with your hand on the person in front of you, just to make sure you don't get separated.
Bradshaw waited for both teams to get into position before giving the go-ahead. It was absolutely vital that both attacks were coordinated. Only when he was certain both teams were ready did he give the order to assault.
Go! Go! Go!
Inside the SEALs' territory, they were ready to go. First, they threw in the flashbang grenades. These grenades are used in many close combat hostage situations.
Depending on the mission will depend on how many grenades and what type of grenades you're going to carry. There's diversionary grenades, flash crashes, or flashbangs they're called. And we use those before going into a building to shock the occupants of that building or that cave.
Then, alert and ready, they stormed the caves.
When you enter a cave, you go in there and you flood that area. And it's all eyes, and you are looking for threats, immediate threats. You have people looking right, people looking left, people looking at the center of the cave. In 2 seconds, that whole cave, that initial entry, is covered by at least 4 shooters. They see the corners, they see the center of the room, they identify furniture or obstructions where people can be behind. They'll say, move, his partner will say, moving. He'll look behind that rock or that cabinet or whatever it is. The first thing you have to do when going into a building or a cave or any place like this is look for threats. You gotta stop that threat from being able to hurt anybody on your assault team.
In just minutes, it was over. The kidnappers were dead. As the smoke cleared, the SEALs searched the dead kidnappers for intelligence and weapons, but they didn't find any hostages. Back in the ops room, the commanders were alarmed. Was it too late? Had the hostages been moved yet again? Or worse, had they been handed off to the Taliban? For a moment, the commanders held their breath. Everything was dependent on what the SAS found in their location.
Then you go in, you're in full motion then. Everything is just heightened to such a point whereby you don't know you're killing, you're just doing it. And you know you're killing the right target. You know you're slotting the right target. You know that what you've been briefed and the intelligence is all fitting into place. The element of surprise is gone since the first bullet's been put, the first trigger's been pulled. And then it's speed, aggression, and surprise.
As the SAS moved in, they were spotted by the kidnappers. They responded with a barrage of shots.
People know when the shit hits the fan, it goes No plan. You go for plan B. Plan A doesn't work, plan B.
SAS fighters tore through the cave network, gunning down anyone who attempted to stop them. After several minutes, there wasn't any more movement or resistance. They took a moment to calm down.
5 minutes, that's an awful long time. And then when it's all done, it's all quietened down, the shouting starts, the screams start of the wounded. There's all sorts of nonsense that's going on. A smoke from the flashbang still going around, people screaming, people shouting. But you're all aware of this, and you know, and the main thing is find out, have you been shot? Because the adrenaline's up. You know, I've known people to be shot and still sort of carry on walking. Then you worry about your mates. Who's, you know, how are they? But that doesn't come until a couple of minutes later, because the threat, you're still on the enemy territory and you still got to be switched on.
Helen and Mor Garway were there, alive and well. And so were the Afghan aides. The SAS briefly checked the women for any serious wounds or injuries. Then they were hustled out of the cave. The mission was going well, but it wasn't over yet.
Just because you've got the hostage and you've killed these sons of bitches, there could be another load coming up around the corner. So you've still got to be switched on. You don't stay on target too quick, you get the hell out of there. Okay, you exfil, you get out there rapid.
The soldiers carried the women the entire 2 miles back to the helicopter landing site. Their earlier coordination was well-timed. The helicopters were back. The groups piled into the choppers and headed back to Kabul. Within hours, they reached ISAF headquarters.
But it's really not till you land and get home and get the hostage off safely to the docks or the medical crew or the intel folks are going to take the hostages away. Can you really take a deep breath? The op's not over till you get home.
Now, the mission was over, and a success. After 12 terrifying days, the hostages were back in safety. Operation Jubilee became an example of well-executed in-and-out hostage rescue. All the kidnappers were eliminated, and no members of the Special Forces teams had even been hurt. In the early hours of the morning, Downing Street was informed that the rescue mission had been a complete success.
So once Helen Johnson is back safely at the Special Forces base in Kabul, ISAF essentially, the Prime Minister is informed, probably informed earlier, that the mission has been successful, that she's safely back. Congratulations all round. From his point of view, a huge sigh of relief, because he is the person who has said yes or no. So if it goes wrong, you know, okay, the actual commanders on the ground will be blamed, but he will be feeling it as well. So from his point of view, you know, there's nothing as good as a special forces operation working successfully that you can brag about.
Later that same morning, outside 10 Downing Street, Prime Minister David Cameron gave a press conference announcing the mission's success.
From the SAS point of view, from the Special Forces point of view, it was a textbook operation. It's always going to be a textbook operation if you get them out alive. You know, firstly, let's look at the options. Get them out alive, get the hostages out alive, kill all the kidnappers, make sure you recover all your forces. If you can do that, that's textbook. That's it, you've done it, you're successful. That's 10 out of 10, it doesn't get any better than that. You know, but the most important thing was to get the hostages out alive. I think if anything had happened, you would have had back-to-back hostage operations where it had been a failure, and then you have a problem. Then everyone starts getting scared. So it was really important that this went well, that this worked for everybody, and it did.
You know, a lot of people who might not understand how these things go would think, well, that's how it's supposed to happen. But to make all the pieces connect and all that training and all those guys who have done all that training and all the things that could have gone wrong, for them to come out with a perfect report, hostages okay, SEALs okay, terrorists dead, it's a super big achievement, and it's what SEALs live to do.
For both the SAS and the SEALs, the mission couldn't have gone better. This was far from the last hostage mission they would have to negotiate, but it gave them a good example and jumping off point for all future rescues.
And then comes out later that morning, that same morning, and briefs the British media, and actually says, you know, the other side of this, sort of the narrative to this whole story, as well as getting the getting the hostages back is, don't mess with the British. Don't kidnap our people, because this is what's going to happen to you.
In the next episode, as the charismatic and powerful Fidel Castro took control of Cuba, the United States feared communism would spread out from their neighbor nation. And the CIA decided the best way to get to him would be to use someone he loved. A young woman named Marita Lorenz found herself mixed up with both the Cuban dictator and, perhaps more dangerous, the desperate CIA.
I was reading the article on the New York Times. Fidel Castro, rebel, Cuba. I was reading that. I said, I just met him. And the phone rang, and it was Fidel. He said, how are you? I miss you. And with his bad English, asked me to come back.
That's next time on Covert. Covert is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It is produced by Audio Boom's Ben Hosley, Rachel Jacobs, and Karen Bevan, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had additional production help from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabengwa. David McNabb is the series' creative director, and the executive producers for Audio Boom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. And if you've got some time, give us a review.